And here we go. All right. Okay, so hello and welcome to this Popgnosis episode of Talkgnosis. Today we're going to be talking about the Netflix phenomenon Sandman, created by Neil Gaiman. I'm Jason Memel, and I'm joined with my co-host, Bea Skolnick. Say hi, Bea.
Hello.
And so if you're new to Gnosticism, the absolute shortest way I can describe it is kind of a deeper knowing that you can't learn or be taught, but you can discover through faith, mystical exploration, or my favorite, art. It can be described as you remembering something you didn't know you forgot. And a lot of older traditions have a whole cosmology of figures that are either trying to keep us from remembering or at the very least get in the way of remembering. On Popgnosis, we take a look at culture around us through a Gnostic lens. Sometimes the connections are direct and easy to see, and sometimes they're maybe lurking just underneath and need to be uncovered and with a little bit of digging. And so that's what we're doing here. Today we're going to talk about Sandman, which is a Netflix TV show based on a Neil Gaiman comic that he's done with a lot of other artists. And I'm going to go do a quick synopsis, and then we'll dive in. So Sandman, if you're not already aware, even if you are, just to kind of set the stage, is about a figure named Dream. Dream is in charge of everything involved with the act of dreaming, and he's a kingdom of the world of dreams, and he has siblings who are in charge of other elements of the world, like death. They're all D-themed. A magician traps Dream in about 1910, 1920, which curses the world to decades of bad sleep. Dream escapes. He has to quest to find the fragments of his power, involving all kinds of horrible nightmares wreaking havoc in the world. He also has to figure out what to do with Rose, a woman who is a dream vortex and who could bring all of the dreaming down, maybe in the world. Alongside all of these bigger stories, we get interludes and side stories. We discover the Dream has been meeting the same person at a bar for 600 years, a person who's decided not to die. That's it. He's just decided not to die. We discover Dream of a Thousand Cats, in which humans once lived in a world controlled by cats, and which the humans changed by dreaming of a different world. We discovered that Dream was once married to Calliope, a Greek muse of inspiration who's been mishandled by mortals. So the show covers a lot of territory. We just binged it, I think, both Rebecca or Bea and I, over the last few months here. So we're excited to talk about it, to talk about what we enjoyed, but also talk about the Gnostic connections and that sense of perhaps remembering something we didn't know we forgot. How was that synopsis? Is there anything you wanted
bravo.
To add to that?
Yeah, bravo. No, you did great. I loved it. And you even touched on my favorite episode, which was the meeting in the bar, I think was probably my favorite episode of the series. So
maybe not cool.
Immediately, but we'll get back to it at some point. I'd love to talk more about that. But yeah, that's, you hit all the bullet points.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I should say is that if you haven't seen the show and you're interested in what we're talking about, none of what I said can spoil it, because despite you knowing some of these bits are going to happen, the craftsmanship of the show and the quality of the performances, the quality of the show, I find so high that that watching it is enjoyable, even if you know what's happening.
And I think the stories are old too. Like it really fits kind of in this world of Popgnosis that we're looking at, because I think so many of the characters and the stories, and it is very cyclical in nature as a show itself, and like as a world, it's all things that we are familiar with on some level. So I really do love this framing of it, of Gnosis being a remembering of something that you have forgotten, or that kind of feeling. Yeah, it just evokes a feeling in me. And I think the show kind of encompasses that feeling as well, because there is this Inception, that Christopher Nolan movie, like there's this Inception tinge to it that's like what's real and what's happening in the waking world, what's happening in the dreaming world, and the like liminal space between the two.
Yeah, well, and like it's... So like, I guess it would live in this world of sort of, I would call it like sort of modern fantasy, but it's also got this kind of more like fairy tale aspect to it, where like there are things that the show doesn't stop to explain, like in the sense that like other kinds of fantasy and sci-fi would be like, okay, if this is going to happen, we need to tell the audience how it works, you know? But like, so for example, there's a woman in the show who gets pregnant in her dream and then wakes up pregnant. And there, like, you're not, no one is given any information as to how that happened, like how that works.
Yeah. Other than like the smallest bit of like nugget of information is like, oh, it has to do with this dream vortex. And then, yes, you're left to be like, okay, I will fill in my own blanks on that one, on the biology of that one.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, and it's a, there's something interesting there about, I don't know, maybe there's something there about like mythology and art and poetry, like a lot of this living in a space in which you don't explain it, you just tell it, if that makes sense. Like you just kind of, this is what's important to the story, or this is what's resonant or what have you. And so it's not going to be like, you're not going to get what am I trying to say here? Like a detective like explanation of it. You're not going to get it dissected for you. You know?
Yeah. Well, this might be a great place to dive in because I know you're familiar with the source material, the comics, in a way that I am not. And so that's very much a visual medium, but also written word, you know, very storybooky, or can be kind of what you're talking about. But I also think that in film or television, there is this notion of show, don't tell, like use the visual format to reveal things that, so you're not giving your characters like extraneous dialogue if you could show something visually. So I think that is a really interesting way of looking at the series as a whole, is like, how do they lean on the visual world? And then I guess my question to you would be, how does that compare to the comics? And
so that's like, it's, I mean, comics and adaptation have kind of had a really interesting history. There have been some works that have used comics only as a springboard, and they essentially disregard the comics as anything other than the vague concept, you know, maybe the franchise if it's popular. And then you've now got like things like the Marvel movies, which are inspired by the comics, but not often referencing a single specific book, you know? So it's more of like a general like gestalt of these characters that is kind of like clearly, you know, with borrowings from different specific books. And then you've got other works where like Zack Snyder was famous for both Watchmen and 300 for essentially trying to duplicate the panel, like the same angle, the same physical posture, you know, the same colors, like that, really trying to get it down. And so in all of those, I think what's interesting is that the fan is sitting there looking at it going, what am I, like, how is what I'm seeing relate to what I saw before? And in like Zack Snyder's case, it's like, it's attempts to duplicate. And in some of those other cases, it's a separate thing. You know, it's clearly going in a different direction. Sandman lives in this strange world where, I mean, that just fits as a sentence, but it lives in a strange world in which the fan is both rewarded and surprised in the show, which I was really impressed by. Like, that I was never bored because I knew exactly what was going to happen, but I felt rewarded because I had this extra level of engagement and knowledge about how they were going to do something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
So I was like, yeah, I was very, very impressed in terms of the way they adapted it as an experience of both accessible to somebody who has never read the comics and accessible and engaging for a fan. I think which is fascinating. Which also, this is the Gnostic element there maybe as well, is that, like, you know, a lot of ancient Gnosticism, or our approach to ancient Gnosticism, comes through text. And I think there is something interesting here as well about something that has a mythological context, that had a previous text, that is still working within it, an attempt to inspire and engage people who are familiar with both, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I had a feeling of, like I was saying there before about that remembering something you didn't know you forgot. I had that feeling while watching the show of like remembering an element in the comic that I didn't know I'd forgotten, or seeing an element that connects to but does not duplicate. if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Like,
so it created these sort of aha moments, you know, around like sort of so some of the mythological connections and the more like psychological elements of like what's happening in Dream's head and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's like, and there are things like with that, the baby that was born in the dream, there's kind of a thing that I'm sitting there going like, how are they going to manage this as it relates to what I know happens in the comic much later on, you know?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
You know, and it's interesting how they've both, maybe it's because it's TV and you don't know how many episodes you're going to get kind of thing. But like on one hand, I think like, oh, they're kind of underplaying something that was bigger in the comic, but they're also not ignoring it. You know, they're not leaving that thread. They're not snipping the thread, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I actually thought the show really was interesting in the threads that they decided to tease and then the ones that they did leave for you. Like, I actually felt like there were quite a few breadcrumbs left throughout the show of either unexplained things or characters, or I guess this is going back to like the, they didn't feel the need to explain themselves throughout. Mm-hmm. Like certain character names are the same. And so you're like, oh, I'm supposed to know that this was you in a former version, maybe, you know, but like, it doesn't really explain it. And so I do feel that they've left themselves in a good place to make season two. Because like you said, they can keep teasing those, but I don't feel like they wasted time in the first season with anything that like couldn't be wrapped up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like none of the breadcrumbs they left felt like the wrong crumb, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Or like not a breadcrumb, but a whole entire slice that they're just like, no, you know, we're going to not use this. Everything felt like if we only got this season, it would have felt cohesive. It would have felt whole.
Yeah. You know, agreed.
And then the other thing, like, so just talking about the again, that whole, it's mythological element and this notion of like, not explaining things. There's a sense in which too, I think this is kind of I think I find resonant in a lot of myth and a lot of like fairy tale epics, those kinds of things, is specifically the notion of mystery. Like that in some cases it's a matter of like not explaining something, but I think in other cases it is a matter of like the mystery is the point. Like we're not going to explain this for you, or something's gonna happen that is dramatic but not set up, if that makes sense. Sometimes a story will feel overly or like, how do I put it, like you can see very clearly, say in a Marvel movie, oh, this is when the hero discovers that they're better than the villain, or you know, like some kind of like really clear hero moment that is connected to an earlier moment that's all very cleanly set up, but also very like, because it's so tightly wound, there's no questions as you walk out, you know? Whereas some of these myths that he's drawing on and just the tradition of like horror fiction and fantasy fiction can often live in this space in which like, we don't know what this is, you know? And you aren't going to find out, and sitting with that is kind of the point. I don't know if I'm making sense, but cool. It's like—
Yeah, of course.
I guess, kind of coming back to that notion of for Gnosticism, like I think there is, like one of the things I think a lot about in Gnosticism is the ineffable, like that we're talking about a connection to something we can't describe, you know?
I know.
So I think there being things in the fiction that we consume that leave space for the indescribable. Maybe that's what I'm kind of getting at, you know?
Yeah.
Like the three witches, or not three witches, but the three fates.
Oh, the fates. Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I loved that interpretation of them so much. Yeah. So there are these three fates, and they appear multiple times in the series, both to Dream as helpers, and then also to Rose, the human who is the Dream Vortex. Later on in the series, and they appear in the form of the same woman, but in maiden mother crone versions of her, which I also think is so, was just so visually stunning. And yes, they are very much speaking in questions and not so much in riddles, but they are, they have rules of how they are going to deliver information. And yes, I just loved the, that interpretation of them, and also kind of a little Hecate in there as well, kind of, which is mother, maiden, crone. But yeah, I just, I loved the interpretation of the fates.
And there's also, they do show up in the Calliope story as well, the Muse one.
Cool.
I won't say much more than that, but I will say maybe, I think in that episode, and maybe even in the Rose one, it's a maiden, mother, crone, but they're not actually all the same woman because they're actually sometimes different ethnicities.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool.
In at least one of them, I think. I'm not 100%, but I think so again, this kind of gets back to an element that I like, in which there's a theme, but not a rule in how some of this stuff is presented. Like the three women will appear, but they won't always look exactly the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and again, there's that notion of like not letting you get comfortable. Oh, this is, here's the trio. I know what this is. I know exactly what this is, you know?
Yeah.
And sorry, I'm going to go off on a tangent here.
Go.
But so the maiden, mother, crone, I got really interested in this and I did some Googling, and like, I guess the popular image we have of it, and the image that they use in Sandman, is kind of mostly traces itself back to Robert Graves, who had a, I think it's either the White Goddess or the Greek Myths series that he wrote. And that like current scholarship is kind of not sure that he got it right. Like, in fact, like they're fairly critical that it's more of like a poetic invention more so than a historical fact in some of these cases.
Specifically, and to the fates, or in this larger mythos of maiden, mother, crone?
The larger mythos, like the maiden, mother, crone, you know, sort of feeling of it. But I've also been like watching a lot of Joseph Campbell videos and like reading works by him. And there's kind of a sense in which I'm like, whether or not there is a historical precedent for what, for the archetype, it doesn't mean the archetype doesn't exist and didn't exist, if that makes sense.
Sure.
As you mentioned, like Hecate has a trio aspect to her, and there are the three fates, and like, so, you know, maybe Graves might have been stating things as history that are more like aesthetics, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And that scholarship is maybe disagreeing with him on that point, but I still agree with the archetype he's tapping into, if that makes sense. And like, I guess where I'm kind of going with this again is that like, I think something like Sandman doesn't, I mean, because it's fiction, almost doesn't even have to worry even as much as Graves does. you know?
Yeah. Like, well, it's just using something that's kind of in the collective conscience to say, okay, we all understand this. I would add for the maiden, mother, crone, I'm not actually familiar with Graves or his work, but right off the bat, I was like, oh, interesting. I would like a female or a non-binary, like a genderless perspective kind of on this very gendered topic of maiden, mother, crone. But it really is kind of just these within a life cycle. It's saying youth, kind of like youth, power, wisdom was Pythagoras's breaking up of a life. And so that's kind of what maiden, mother, crone does as well, is saying these are different roles that we will play in our lives, and different ages and different, it does evoke a feeling. Like, we're actually having this conversation on Yule, on the winter solstice, which is Hecate's day. Yeah. Because it's very much about like past, present, and future. And three does seem to be, and it's a 3-day. If you do the numerology on today, it's a 3.
Yeah.
So it's all very aligned. Like, it does have this energy of these three different kind of chapters of human life or experience. So we have our, when we're young, Or the maiden we have when we are in our power, when, and that has to do with creativity as a whole, not just mother as like pregnant or childbearing, but mm-hmm. in your creative power, what are you bringing forth? And then in the crone, you know, how, when we age, like, how are we turning that into wisdom? How are we allowing, especially here, like at the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, how are we interacting with death, dying, or like the idea of being fallow? So mm-hmm. I do think there's a lot of potent symbolism within all of those things. And like you're saying, there might not be scholarly historical, you know, information to support some of these things, but they definitely exist through myth, through story, and exactly. through like repeated symbolism. That's one of my mm-hmm. favorite things about the soup of kind of occult or esotericism or
totally.
Philosophy or religion, is that you can see all of these threads like throughout culture and story. So on some level, they must be true. Like they must make sense to us or be useful.
Exactly. No, I think that's exactly. Well, and I think useful versus true is the thing that I think a lot about.
sure, that's fair.
You know, like, because there's like, religion is often myth that is trying also to be history, I find. Like, I mean, that is very reductive. And I mean, I'm not a religious scholar, but...
That's okay. Here on Popgnosis, we are reductive.
yeah, exactly. This is the Wild West here. But that the reason I mention that is because, like, I often see, say, on, like, Gnostic subreddits or, like, online groups and things like that, are people kind of saying, like, you know, what is the, like, what does Gnosticism think about this, you know, text or this religion or this, like, you know, theological point or what have you, as though we're talking about things that are like almost like laws, you know, like these documents that have been written in this very like sort of specific way, this is how this works. And that if you can't find that history, if you can't find that document, then it's not valid somehow, you know? And that's, that's why I've been kind of saying, like, it doesn't have to be true in the sense that ancient Gnostics wrote a text that proves point A for point A to be still useful for you.
I love this conversation so much. I really do. I think it's so juicy because also it just takes into account like history versus progress as well, which again, we're kind of looking in past, present, future. Like, what did they say? What's useful to us now? But like, how is it going to help us get to where we want to go? And so I totally understand the desire for historical accuracy and context. And I think it's absolutely, I'm definitely not platforming myself to say like, chuck out history or anything.
No,
like,
no.
We need it. But I think that what you're talking about is so interesting because there used to be no separation between the practical and the mystical, even kind of in some of these ancient universities or early religious scholars and the people who are writing the texts that we want to talk about so badly. We're not necessarily looking at a worldview in which they separated kind of miracle or that which is ineffable from that which they could explain or codify or whatever. And now we have in our modern culture, I think we have separated those a lot. And so we want to return to magical, and I include religion in magical. We want to return to magical spaces that require magical thinking with a logic and like with rationale that's absolutely has a place, but like does not kind of trample the magical.
No. So or we the have poetical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so that is what we're talking about here, especially with a story like Sandman, which does evoke such a feeling space and an imaginative space. And I do want to talk about change as it exists in the series.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's kind of what we're talking about. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll get off my imaginative soapbox. But okay, so I think change in the world of Sandman is super fascinating to me. And I think it comes down to who is the storyteller and the fact that And this might be a spicy hot take, but like if God is a construct, right? Or if gods in this key, like if gods are characters that were created by humans, we inherently like to anthropomorphize our gods in our storytelling because they take on human characteristics, they take on human form. You know, in Sandman, we do have some more fantasy forms, but for the most part, they're played by human actors looking like humans. And especially in Sandman, I have been thinking about how, so the siblings are all called the Endless. So his, and they're, I think you had mentioned this, that they are somehow in the hierarchy higher than gods. Like they hold more power. They're kind of just these constructs. But that they are in service. They do act in service to humanity, but in some ways they are also kind of envious of the human experience or wanting to understand the human experience, which I just think as a, now getting really meta with it, it's like human beings writing about gods wanting to be human beings and really kind of not romanticizing the human experience, but there is an element of like fascination and curiosity with being human. But then, so in this story, we see death. I definitely want to talk about her, but Desire. Yeah. We haven't spoken about the sibling Desire who shows up. This is also kind of what I love about Sandman is it's always weaving itself in on it, like in on itself. So Desire doesn't show up in the physical form until like the last couple of episodes, but we learn that they've definitely had a hand in the, like in what we've seen throughout the show. They've had a hand in that, even if they haven't been introduced to us. And so we find out that a lot of this kind of above the fray is really Desire wanting to mess with Dream. And so the human beings, even though they are supposedly acting in service to humans, are also kind of fodder for their gameplay, like on this higher level. So, and then I guess my final thought about change is that then we also see, because I was kind of thinking, you know, Gnosticism doesn't have to be a heroic journey. And I don't think that's the only or the most potent way of storytelling necessarily. But I was thinking like, who is the hero in this story? And you could definitely say that Dream is a hero in the story. Not meaning he does good things, just meaning like he is the central figure who goes on a journey and actually does have to change in the course of that, which I also think is fascinating because if he's a god, then how are we putting, like, wouldn't you think like gods wouldn't have to change? Gods would be these like idealized, perfect forms. So I just think the messiness of humans writing gods being humans is like very fascinating to me.
Totally. Yeah. Well, so like, I think there's a sense where, this was something I put in our notes about this idea. Like, so, again, in case anybody's watching this who's more familiar with Sandman than Gnosticism, there's a whole concept in a lot of classical Gnosticism of archons, these figures that are, you know, possibly like angels or like, you know, demigods or what have you, that are kind of part of the system that is keeping you from connecting to Gnosis, connecting to that source or that kind of remembering. And in some versions, there it's very overt. Like their job is to keep you down. You know, same thing with the demiurge, their boss. Like their job is to like enforce the rules of the world. And some one of those rules is you don't get out. Like you don't get to connect to anything bigger. And so, whereas in this case, I think what you're saying there about them being like both being like more powerful than gods, being these like, you know, like hugely cosmic figures that are also somehow in service to humanity, that are like doing it because of us, And that's even a line from the show. I think Death is like, Death says, like, you know, we're here for them. She also has a great line. Death is a young woman, kind of in like sort of goth clothes, who's kind of like perky and fun, but also wise. And she says at one point, like, I was there when the first living thing opened its eyes, and I will be there at the end to turn out the lights and put up the chairs.
The Death episode, if you have to watch one episode of Sandman, I knew we were going to get back to it because it's my favorite, is the Death episode. It's such a like sweet and interesting take on Death. And the idea is that Dream, it's his sister. So Dream mm-hmm. like reunites with Death and follows her around for a mourning as she is with people at while she transitions people, essentially, like takes them out of the living and back. And so mm-hmm. he's just going about her day with her, but they are having these very interesting conversations. And then that leads right into the person that he has been meeting every 100 years for however yeah. long, because he and we flash way back to like 14 something. And he and Death are in a tavern together, and they overhear someone, this man basically saying, why does everyone have to die? I just won't do it. Mm-hmm. And so Death hears him, and they have this Dream and Death have this cheeky little moment together where they say, okay, we'll grant that for him. And so Dream, who also that's this man's dream to never die. So it is this mm-hmm. cool interplay. So Dream yeah. walks over and he's like, I'll grant you your dream based on my sister Death, who's also okayed this plan. And so you can live forever. But you have to meet with me every 100 years and tell me essentially why you still want to be alive. Like, let's see mm-hmm. if your answer has changed the longer that you're in the world. And so then they start meeting every 100 years, and some 100 years have been kinder to this man than others. Mm-hmm. And they finally meet. Spoiler alert, I'm just going to say mm-hmm. it, because this is what I think you were talking about earlier, with these really well-crafted moments within mm-hmm. it that you're like, oh yeah, I forgot we were even talking about this. And now I remember. So they get into a fight. they get into a fight one time when they meet each other, because the man says, I think you're lonely. I think you're really fascinated with human beings. I think you kind of want to be one. And I think mm-hmm. that you keep meeting me every 100 years because we're friends. And Dream has this wild reaction. And it's like, we are not friends. I am not who mm-hmm. you think I am. And I will leave. Like, we'll never see each other again. And so the man says, in 100 years, when we meet again, if you show up, it will be because we are friends. Mm-hmm. Which I also felt to be like quite wholesome in the middle of the story. And so the next time they're supposed to meet, Dream doesn't show up. He stands the man up. And then they flash to Dream in the magician's, where he was being held by the magician. Mm-hmm. And you realize, oh my gosh, it's not because they were not friends. It's because, of course, he was imprisoned for mm-hmm. that specific amount of time. And I had totally, at that point, I did not expect them to connect that story back to the larger, I don't know, for me, I was like, oh my gosh, that's right. Like, that's when he was in prison. So maybe everyone watching it is smarter than me, but that was just a moment of like, oh, right. And then mm-hmm. 100 years later, they do meet again in the present. They are friends.
And well, and I think Robert says something essentially indicates that, you know, you've changed. Mm-hmm. And your point about change is, I think, really interesting too, because there's a quality in which, like, Dream presents himself as like, I am the endless, I am Dream, I've always been Dream. These are the rules, this is how the world works, like, this is it. And but that the process of having been going through, been trapped for like 80 years by this magician, and he's just basically in a glass bottle for, you know, like this like big gigantic bottle for 80 years, just sit, and he's silent for that long, that it does change him. And I think there's something like kind of going back to, again, this notion of like archons that are like, you know, in charge of the world. I think there's something really interesting about this idea of the archons. If we're saying that the Endless are slightly archonic in the sense that they have a job, but that they can change, you know?
They have a profession. That's what makes them archonic, yeah.
Yeah. well, because, you know, like a lot of times when we think of like, especially like Greek gods or something like that, they're more like forces of nature with a face, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas this does feel more like a person who has a job that just happens to be bigger than the universe. Like,
yes. You know? Yeah. Well, and that he doesn't expect his realm to change either. Like when he mm-hmm. comes back, so there's this return after he escapes capture, and he returns back to his realm, like the land of dreams. Mm-hmm. And he's very surprised to see that it has changed in his absence. And then one of his creations, so I guess like the main villain of season one would be the Corinthian, who mm-hmm. is this figure who wears glasses to hide the fact that he doesn't have eyes. Mm-hmm. And
what does he have instead of eyes?
What does he have instead of eyes? Did I miss it?
He has teeth in his eyes.
Oh, yes, of course. Because the skull at the very end.
Yeah.
I looked and I was like, I need that skull. Like, I don't know why, but I just like, want to have that skull. That skull. Yes, he has teeth instead of eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is so gross and weird in the in the CGI of it all. Mm-hmm. Yes, and he goes around taking out other people's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this very interesting real world kind of, again, he belongs in the dreamland, but he's mm-hmm. living in the waking land because dream has been captured. So nobody has been playing that. Nobody's been doing his job. And so mm-hmm. kind of when he comes back, he's surprised to see that all of his creations are kind of running amok as well.
You know, okay, I'm sort of edging my way into my own hot take here. So one of the things about the Corinthian as well is like in this period the dream is trapped, it's suggested that the Corinthian has not through like magic powers in terms of making people do it, but through literally by like setting an example by being this like murderous person moving out in the human world, he's essentially inspired a community of serial killers.
Yes.
And there's a moment where I think it's when the Corinthian is defeated by the Sandman, that the Sandman says to everybody, because he says to everybody, you have thought that you were, you know, that you were heroes, that you were hunters, that you were important. And I am telling you now just how small you all really are. And like how little your personal narratives truly mean. Like he's kind of mean about it, but I mean, he's talking to a room full of serial killers, so like they deserve it. But where I'm backing into my hot take here is that there's like, I think it's fair to say that we're living in a world right now where there have been a lot of people who have been hijacked by narratives that make them feel like they're more powerful. You know,
mm-hmm.
And there was something really resonant about watching a guy with magic powers just like rip the bad narratives out of them. You know,
yeah.
It's like that's kind of a fantasy that you know you wish could happen, and I think it also happens in a lot of expressions of Gnosticism. Don't focus on gnosis. On connecting to a divine source, on exploring what that divine source is, they're really just documenting the archons and the demiurge, and like they want it to be as much about They want to revel in the bad stuff because it makes them feel less. It explains the bad, but it doesn't. That's all it does. Like it's just focusing on the prison bars, if that makes sense.
And it's touching a very real place, which is that at the end of the day, why do we turn to story? And everything mm-hmm. is story. And why do we turn to stories that specifically talk about the construct of the universe, like how it, the cosmogony, the cosmology, mm-hmm. like how it came to be, how it will end? Like, why are we drawn to that? Because we want to explain the ineffable, and we want to answer unanswerable questions, because mm-hmm. sometimes it is scarier to sit in the unknown. With our own mortality and our own ignorance, and to sit in all that we don't know. And so anything that makes us feel safer or more certain or whatever,
or more powerful,
right, more in control, is attractive. Like, that's attractive to us. Mm-hmm. And so also in Sandman is this notion that Dream has been captured. So he's not without his own limitations, because mm-hmm. then, first of all, he's captured by a human, and there is some level of like, that's embarrassing. Like, he can't go, you know what I mean? Like, he can't go back and like tell people that he was captured by a magician for X amount of years, because somewhere in like that upper echelon of the endless, like, that's embarrassing that he got caught, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then his quest at first, there are actually, it's quite nonlinear. First season is quite nonlinear, and there are like sections to the storytelling. Like, the story mm-hmm. that we get in the first few episodes kind of wraps, and then we get this new story, and then that kind mm-hmm. of wraps. So there are definitely chapters to it, but the first chapter upon his escape is him reclaiming these three tools, his sand, his ruby, and
his mask.
Yes. Yeah. And so he has to go to different realms and try and discover like where these tools are, but essentially without them, he also isn't as powerful. So mm-hmm. we really are watching a story of a God who has a lot of mortal properties to him, like a lot of mortal characteristics.
And I think he even says at one point, like, as he's like, I think when he gets the final piece, he goes like, I think you've taught me that I put too much of myself in tools.
Yes. You know? Which is also very much like we're putting too much of our, we're putting too much into texts or into, mm-hmm. I'll just speak like as a witch, as a witch, like I use tarot or I use numerology, but I'm very clear that those are tools that I'm using to access different information or different parts of myself or mm-hmm. to connect with different energies. But my magic is not in a tarot deck. It's in me, and I use a tarot deck. So even without it, I should be able to make those connections. And I think actually gnosis is direct experience. So it would mm-hmm. be without tools.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, the tools could like create a space in which, like at their best, tools can create a space in which you then let gnosis through, you know? But then the flip side of that is only seeing the tool, you know? Mm-hmm. Only focusing on if you're following the rules of your tools, if that makes sense. Like, like I only do tarot readings that are Kabbalistic crosses, and I only do them at like, you know, this time or this way or what have you, versus like what is creating space for a feeling that's bigger than the tool, you know? Mm-hmm. And then Dream sort of figures out like, maybe I'm putting too much in this.
you know? And it's only when the ruby breaks mm-hmm. and then he becomes like literally huge, like enormous. Yeah. And which that whole, there are some stunning visual sequences in the show for sure that are really cool. Mm-hmm. But he becomes enormous, and then it kind of leaves those tools behind. He's mm-hmm. much more able to, the sand makes another appearance, of course, but yeah. like he's able to move forward kind of without the mask and without, which I also think is symbolically interesting that he mm-hmm. doesn't ever wear it again. Yeah. And that it's when the ruby breaks and the tool breaks that he actually kind of assumes the height of his power. And he says, he has a line about being like the most powerful, that he like kind of returned to that raw power and mm-hmm. not knowing what exactly to do with it, feeling kind of unsure about that. Mm-hmm. And almost like he forgot what it was like to be at his full power until the tools were literally destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of forced into that return. I don't know, there's something. Yeah.
Well, yeah, like a lot of like, I think, what would it be like, say, ascetic mystical practices are involved stripping things away, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes even like missing it creates a space to think about why you're missing it and to create, you know what I mean? Like creates a space in which you can think other things or think wider. I mean, even just meditation has kind of an element of that, like trying to, I was just talking about this today, like sometimes I'm meditating and I'll have a thought about like my job or my family or something, and it'll be like, oh, I should remember that. Maybe I should write it down. No, the point right now is to actually try letting go, you know?
Yeah, when I lead clients through a meditation, like at the beginning of readings or something, mm-hmm. there's always a point where, you know, we touch in with the intentions that we're bringing to a space or the questions that that they might be bringing. And I guide them to let those thoughts bubble up. And I just offer, maybe you catch them as they go by, but maybe you don't. You actually let them up and out, and you trust that when you need to reclaim them, that they'll be there somewhere in your ether.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, again, easier said than done, because we like to attach to our thoughts.
Totally. Yeah. We're used to attaching to thoughts. Like in a way, meditating is like, I remember one point I was meditating and then like my neighbors were being loud or something. And I was like, at first I was like, oh, don't, you know, I'm trying to do something spiritual here. They should be quiet. But then I'm like, no, me stepping out of the world for a minute, I'm the one doing the weird thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and me letting go of my frustration at their disturbance of my peace is a thing to let go of. You know what I mean? Like it's
that you have to be, again, providing that setting or those conditions to have a spiritual experience instead of allowing it to be completely integrated, that no matter where you are or what's happening, you are still able to pull inwards and have that experience kind of regardless of what else is going on.
Totally. I wanted to go back to your point about desire and dream and their like sibling fighting and the nature of it being like the capacity for them to be human, even though they're bigger than gods. Like I want to connect back to that, but I do also want to just do a quick Patreon shout out.
Yes.
So before we get to to some extra good stuff here, I'll just mention that doing a show like this, we can't really do it without your support. We've got like server costs and the time costs involved in building a lot of this stuff and getting the shows ready. And so if you feel like you're interested in contributing, you can contribute as little or as much as you like at patreon.com/gnostic. I'll put it up on the screen here. That's one way you can contribute. That's I think you can set it to however much you want, and you can set it for every time we do a thing, or you can set a max. So like, whatever suits your needs, that we're good with there. We've also got paypal.me/gnostic if you want to just do a one-time donation or a specific lump sum. You can reach most of us on social media or the internet pretty easily if you just want to reach out. And another way you can help us is literally by just sharing the show, telling other people about it. If we've said something that you've got a question about that you want one of your friends to answer, send it to them and like start a conversation, and then get back to us, put it in the chat or put it in the like Reddit or Facebook or wherever it is you might be finding this show. With that said, so the thing about Desire and Dream. So Desire is a fascinating character. They're depicted as, I would say, non-binary would be the best way to describe it.
I would definitely say that, but they are specifically gendered at one point in the show in a fascinating way that, can I spoil it?
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay, well, so they, so Rose, the Dream Vortex, we find out way in the beginning of the show that when Dream is captured, some people fall into a coma-like sleep for years and years and years. And so we see this young woman fall asleep and is unable to wake up. And then later in the show, we realize that Rose, this Dream Vortex, is the granddaughter of the woman who we have seen sleep, essentially, for however long. And she woke up the day that Dream had escaped. And so there's two sleeping pregnancies, one in the present, but then also this woman reveals that she dreamt that she had a child, but when she woke up, she realized that that had actually happened. And then it's revealed that Desire was the father of that baby that ultimately led to Rose, like in lineage. Yeah, so yeah. Desire is definitely androgynous, definitely, I think, would fall under the non-binary, like somewhere in the non-binary space. But they are said to be the father of this child, which I thought was really fascinating.
Well, and I think it's probably fair to say that if Desire wanted to be a mother, that they could do that too.
Sure, totally. You know, totally.
Like,
yeah.
The way that character is represented, it's like you kind of feel like all of that is within their power. And so, yeah, so they've got a sibling rivalry thing going. We don't really kind of know what started it exactly. I can't remember if it's covered in the comics. Maybe somebody in online will remind me. But so they've got a sibling rivalry, and which dates from before Dream was trapped. And the Dream that didn't think he could change was the one who's having the fight with Desire.
Yes.
And it's the Dream that has learned to change that confronts them about what they tried to do. Because there's another element here of, like, it's hinted that that if Dream killed Rose because she's a vortex and could, like, bring down the world, that he'd also be killing a family member, which for the Endless apparently is a really big deal. I think that was interestingly how that was hinted. Where I'm kind of going with this, kind of going back to this whole like archonic thing about like there being spiritual powers that are controlling us or trying to keep us down, et cetera, et cetera. Where I'm kind of going with this is like one of the things that I've heard some really good folks talk about in terms of Gnosticism, specifically in terms of like the Demiurge and the Archons, et cetera, is that it's not that it's all in your head, but that the limiting forces, the things that do get in the way of us having these connections with the divine, are often things that we are engaged in ourselves. Like that, like, so, you know, like time isn't the archon. The archon is that feeling you have that you're late for work and need to rush. You know what I mean? It's not that, like, you know, it's not this divine person who's like take in charge of making sure you're late for things. It's the system that, like, I say, like a highly capitalist system that says you need to be at certain places at certain times in certain ways, that this is how this works. And that kind of that stress is part of something that keeps you from like being chill enough to feel gnosis occasionally. This is a really reductive example, but like, I think there's something interesting here about, and going back to your thought about gods being written about by humans writing about gods, like this kind of recursive element here of like, it's recognizing, and going back to the notion that they are in service of us, it's recognizing that we we can both limit ourselves and free ourselves, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Which is like there's sort of both a liberatory and confining aspect to that. And I think maybe something interesting is that Dream begins to realize that he can change. But I don't know if Desire knows that. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think all Desire knows is like how to revel in these feelings. And that there's like, and that there's only one way to do it, and that's how they're doing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just think there's something really interesting there about this sort of liberatory element of like of the gods changing as we change our ability to see ourselves culturally. You know what I mean? Like if you really just kind of like run wild with this, it's like the idea of the collective unconscious, the like the, you know, the sort of dreamscape imaginarium that the gods live in, you know, somewhere on the, I don't know where it would be on the Kabbalistic tree of life. There's like sort of a layer of like where you could say that these ideas are living at, that layer doesn't enforce down on us. It is imprinted on by us upwards, if that makes sense. Huh, and so yeah. Like, as culture changes, then those imprints start to change. And if we can, and I think like, arguably even, because I think it's maybe even worth noting, Neil Gaiman is a pretty politically engaged individual, a pretty like engaged in popular culture, but definitely not controlled by it. And like has a whole lot of like punches back against, say, folks who are complaining that an actor was cast with a different ethnicity or gender than what was in the comics, that kind of thing. So Neil Gaiman, by trying to create both in the comics and then now with the show, things that have these like these liberatory elements, these mysterious elements that he's like trying to like add to that imprint of culture in ways that are more positive, that do lead like to more, you know, like to dream, going even back to the Maiden Mother Crone, like maybe there wasn't a historical basis the way Robert Graves might have claimed, but enough works like Sandman help create space for that in the dreamscape, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm really rambling. I don't know if that's...
No, all of these words are delicious and delightful.
Okay, great.
Yeah. No, I'm here for this. I think the idea of us imprinting up, yeah, because going back to my hot take that God is a construct, why did we create gods? Why did we create those characters through which, again, to see ourselves and also try and explain something that is larger than us and where we are positionally, like what's our positionality like in the world, what, you know, and our levels of interaction. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, the earliest gods were to explain weather phenomenons and the sun as a god, because it's what we see in the sky every day, and the moon as another god, because that's what comes out later. So kind of going even back to like, why have we created these cultural imprints in the dreamscape? And so as we change, then our imprints also have to change. That's very God is dead. like philosophically of me to be like, you know, God has died, and so now we need new gods. But I do think that there's something in the witnessing of a god or someone like Dream, the endless change, that makes it more accessible to us, that we're like, okay, if that person can change, you know, then we can change as well. And the really interesting thing is it does come with its own kind of humility. So what you were saying about Desire only reveling in the feeling of it, and that kind of being its own trapping, because it doesn't allow for Desire to step outside of that and see other plays or other options. Dream has to give up some sense of power or control in order to enact change in his own realm. He has to apologize to the people that have been working for him or are underneath him. Like, he has a librarian character, you know, Lucius, who is really fascinating to watch their relationship because Lucius really wants to, or Lucienne, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really wants to kind of go to bat for him with other characters, or at least say, think highly of him, where other characters might want to say that he had been abandoned them, he'd allowed himself to get captured. Again, embarrassing. And I do love that, like, it's humiliating what happened to him.
Yeah.
But he has to apologize to Lucienne for not seeing when he came back, you know, the effects, and for not taking her advice at one point, not kind of being open to that. And then the main character, like the real change at the end is with one of the nightmare creations, Gold. So he has reclaimed, like the Corinthian, you know, all of these nightmares while he'd been captured, they'd escaped into the waking world or were running amok in the dream space and had too much power. So he has to like reel them back in. But one of them says, I've changed. Like my time spent without you or with the humans, like I no longer want to be a nightmare. I actually want to be a good dream. I want to be a good force of creativity and like joy. And so at the end, he retools her. He recreates her to be a good dream and like allows her to fly off. And that was like a huge act of change in humility, kind of in dream, to even allow for the idea that not only he could change, but then his past creations, like he could help them live a different life as well, I think was interesting in a way that Desire, you're right, like that's not accessible to Desire right now. And we see that actually in their control over their twin, Despair.
Yeah.
Which that was the only casting that I was like, oh, I don't know. Neil Gaiman and I can talk about that on Tumblr.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's that as well. Yeah, I'd be fascinated to see that exchange.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll say why. Yeah. Despair is like this very is like a fat woman, and I just hated that casting. That I felt like it was the only part of the show that the casting was very deliberately kind of fat phobic, like that this must be Despair. You must feel miserable about yourself. And I felt like that was the only casting. Everything else was pretty ingenious, I thought. But that was the only one that kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah, I know. It's like, well, and so interestingly, like my first response is like that it's actually worse in the comics. You know, like that's one of the castings that felt like they were definitely trying to remind you as much as possible of the comics. Although in the comics she's nude. And so there's like a lot, it's even a more fraught image. It was also like created about 20 some years ago. So there's something cultural context there. I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, one thing we actually haven't talked about as well, just in terms of casting, is like Lucifer.
Oh, yes. Gwendolyn Christie, my beloved.
Yeah. Gwendolyn Christie as Lucifer is amazing. But also as a fan, so different from the comics. Like in the comics, Lucifer is depicted mostly like David Bowie. Okay. Like generally masculine with an element of androgyny, but like... Although when people were upset about Gwendolyn Christie's casting on Twitter and Tumblr and stuff, I think Neil Gaiman's response was like, well, considering that it was a character without a penis, I thought casting an actor without a penis was still appropriate. Like, I thought, which, you know, I'm like, but thank you for punching back, Mr. Gaiman. But where was I going with this? Oh, yeah. Well, and even... Lucifer's perception of themselves and like what they have to be versus what they want to be, like, and the nature of change, like I think that's actually really interesting as well. Sorry, I feel like I jumped into a whole different direction there.
No, I mean, you kind of did just looking at the time. I'm like, oh yeah, we can go here. No, but I think I'm so glad that you brought up Lucifer, and especially in this notion of change, but also in this idea that the characters in the world of Sandman that we are supposed to assume, or that we would assume, have kind of ultimate dominion, actually don't. And Lucifer is another example of that, like supposed to be the god of hell, essentially like the ruler of hell. But at the very end, she finds out that all of the underlings are upset that about what happened with Dream. They dueled and Dream won, and upset about this, and basically are going to force Lucifer into waging war. And so we would think like, oh, Lucifer would be in a position to shut that whole thing down. But in fact, where they leave us at the end of season one, it looks pretty probable that they're going to go to war, or that some, you know, some action will be taken.
Yeah, I can't wait for season two. Like, it's going to be, like, I kind of know what's coming. I hope they go the direction of the comics, if only because I will be super impressed. Like, if it's not, I won't say anymore, cool. But it's so cool. And it connects to this notion of change, of like what even things we think have absolute dominion can change, if they can change. There was something else you said about Lucifer. Oh, shoot. So there's something maybe to mention. I would say it's more in the first half of the season than in the second half, and this actually kind of tracks again to the comics, but the first half of the season lives in kind of a horror movie vibe. Like, there's a lot of horror elements, I would say, to them. Things that are like kind of gruesome or intense, like when Dream is getting his sand back, he realizes that that a human woman has found the sand and basically become addicted to it, and is like, you know, lying in bed, just kept alive by dreaming, you know, which is kind of intense. And then the mask he goes to hell for, and that has horror elements to it just because he's going through hell. There's an interesting moment again in terms of like things they don't explain, where like he walks past a cell and meets a young woman, who says that they were lovers. And in the moment, as he passes by, so I can't remember the actor's name who plays Sandman. I should have checked this.
Oh, Tom Sturridge.
Tom Sturridge. In that moment, when Dream is walking by, he's not played by Tom Sturridge. He's played by a black actor.
Yeah.
Because the woman in the cage is black, which also connects to this idea that the endless are reflections of those that are engaged with them, which also connects to the dream of a thousand cats. We haven't even talked about that.
I know.
That, like, you know, you meet, without giving away too much, I think I kind of said that it's like about humans dreaming a different world that creates the world we're living in. Let me see if I can wrangle these thoughts together. First thing is that, just to connect back to the dream changing themselves, is Dream is a cat in the Dream of a Thousand Cats. You meet Dream as a cat, which is amazing all by itself. But there is, like, going back to this notion of change, and this notion of like us imprinting upwards, that's kind of the premise of Dream of a Thousand Cats, is that the humans are living in a world that cats control. The cats are huge. The cats are big as houses. And humans are these little like servants of them and playthings of them. And then a human gets an idea and says, if we dream of a world where that is different from this one, we'll get that. And it says that, basically things change because a thousand humans dream something different. Mm. And that not only is it like that, it's not that the world was one thing and became another thing. It's that dream literally made it a different world in which the humans have always been in control. So there's a sense of like, maybe we need to start thinking about what dreams we're putting into the air, you know? again, in that liberatory element, like how maybe we dream. And it's also kind of why I do push against versions of Gnosticism that are only focused on archons, on conspiracies, on like the just how, like, you know, how the world is terrible and it's the demiurge keeping you down, because it never makes space for a good dream. You know what I mean? A good, like a sense of like what we're trying to reach beyond that. Sorry, I went on a whole tangent there.
No, it's so great. Yeah. I think there's actually so much social justice and that, like using that umbrella, there's so much theory and there's so, so much written about the way to a different world is through an imaginative dream space, that we need to be able to imagine it first in order to then close the gap between what we have now, like what is reality reflecting now, and what would we like it to reflect. So I think there's a lot of legitimate political theory that would support that claim of dreaming as a way to progress.
Oh, completely. Like, in fact, I think it's true that seatbelts got easier to normalize when like Hollywood started having people put on their seatbelts every time they got in the car.
I'm sure that's true.
Like, yeah, you know, and that I've even heard some of them talk about like an idea around climate change, that if we started representing people just behaving more climate conscious in our popular fiction, without the fiction being about that, just as an element inside it, that it will normalize the conversation, you know.
Representation matters.
Like, it literally does.
It literally does. No, I said that very flippantly, but I do believe that.
Yeah, yeah, me too. Yes. I'll maybe throw out a few last crumbs that are in my head here. Is that like,
Yeah, I have. Great.
There's a thought that that often sometimes comes up when you discuss these ideas of like the archons as, you know, you feeling stressed about your time, that kind of thing, is that people are like, oh, you're just making it all psychology. This is just, you're just psychologizing it. And I think I'm not, but what I think I am trying to do is I'm trying to engage as a modern person in the world, with a way of engaging with the forces that are interacting with me, that doesn't require for me like a much sort of bigger step, and also kind of maybe can let in some narratives that I'm not comfortable with, like that can lead to ideas of like time as a literal policeman that's like trying to make my life suck, if that makes sense. I think that's actually maybe kind of a dangerous image, because then it lets me blame the god for that and not, you know, not engage with my own choices. But all of this is also the reason I'm going here is because a quote I always keep bringing up on this subject is that I think the occultist Lon-Milo Duquette said once, he goes, yes, of course it's all in your head, you just have no idea how big your head is. And I love that. And I think anybody who hears that and thinks that it's just equating psychology to esotericism, etc., hasn't really listened to the quote. Like, you have no idea how big your head is. It's so much bigger than anything you're thinking right now. Like, you know?
Yeah. What is that artwork that's like the layers and somebody peeking behind?
Oh, you mean terrible. Like that sort of classic Gnostic image kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah,
a guy
yeah.
kind of pushing his way through. Yeah.
Yeah, but the whole thing is his head on both sides.
Yeah.
So it's not just like what he's seeing. Yeah, that's what that made me think of.
I mean, like, there's a part of heck, even to tie right back into Gnosticism, if like we're all connected to the divine spark, then we are all a piece of the divine experiencing itself. So it is all one big head anyway.
So
that was just kind of a last piece I wanted to throw there, and also maybe to say that to like a little bit of advocacy here is that like, yeah, if you are thinking as a Gnostic, as an esotericist, you know, like think about the idea that some of these forces, particularly the ones maybe that are more negative, that they can change and you can be part of changing them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also, I thought you brought up a really good point about it all being in your head. One of my kind of like the something stuck in my teeth about Gnosticism is kind of, and a lot of religions do this and a lot of philosophies do this, is kind of damn the body and say, oh, it's a flesh prison or here, like, you know, whatever you want to call it. And so I think what we've been talking about, there is a feeling portion of gnosis that is really easy to intellectualize. But if you don't, then it is a feeling. It exists in the body. I'm even kind of like shaking my shoulders a little bit just talking about it. And feelings, to my knowledge, are fleeting physical experiences. So not only is our human form, like we are not the body, but we are also not the body. So yeah. To demonize it will always kind of separate you from it in a way that might also not be the healthiest of choices. Like you'll inherently be working with a dissociated sense of self. And then also, you know, this is how we experience this world as well. So if we're talking about not intellectualizing philosophy, like it needs to become an embodied, integrated thing. So how you are viewing some of these more esoteric concepts is also how you're going to be entering the world. So I think going back to that like serial killer convention, a lot of what Dream I felt was saying to them was like, you've let somebody tell you you're doing good things and you are not. Like you are not doing good things and you are creating harm. And then you see all of those people walk away. Some feel remorse. Some have to, trigger warning, kill themselves because they can't live with what they have done. It's like he really did kind of pull back the curtain. And behind these narratives that you're telling yourself, like, can you actually stand behind what you've done? Like how you've embodied your own philosophy, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's huge. Yeah. That is huge. Yeah. Yeah. So like, go ahead.
Yeah. Whoa, no, you go.
No, finish your thought, because I think you were going somewhere interesting.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, you know, it's great to wax poetic about all of these things, but then you have to be with the kind of person that you are in the world, because we can also tell stories all day, but we only have this. We only have what we're experiencing. And so, yeah, like, how are you embodying your own philosophies?
That's great. I've got more thoughts on that, but I feel like that's such a good ending line. I don't want to go there. I can come back. maybe the glib version of it is that I think world-hating Gnosticism started because somebody was like hungry and it distracted them from trying to focus on gnosis, and then they're like, damn this body.
Yes, there are many reasons to not be satisfied with the physical form as it exists as an animal. There are plenty of reasons. That is something that I think is interesting of how, you know, we've seen evolution at work, and yet these bodies are still just so funky and in some ways like such a mystery to us still, even though they are quite literally all we know.
Let's focus on everything else because this thing is too confusing.
Right, like pass on that. Yeah.
I think I just want to go back to your sentence there because I think it's really valuable. Like as you're engaging with a lot of these kinds of philosophies and ideas, how are you embodying them, and how are you living in them through the world? Because that's at the end of the day what is going to be true no matter what. You know, is that this is the things you did, you know, as you move through the world. I think that's really important. And I think what Sandman is doing is it's using these mythological and horror themes and family dynamics and cosmic ideas because these are literally embodied elements of forces to really kind of go, what is it to live through these ideas? What happens if these ideas are taken as far as they can go? Is there anything else on the table that you've still, any crumbs you want to put out there?
Oh, Yeah, kind of. I just found it so interesting how many sibling stories were in Sandman, which I thought was an interesting through line. And I'm an only child, so I mainly just have more. Oh, man. All right. We got to get someone with siblings in here. Well, I guess it just left me with more, more questions. But I thought it was really interesting to. So the first siblings that we see are actually once Dream. Oh, no, no, no. I'm going to take it back. The magician that captures Dream has a son that's living and also a son that has died. And so his initial reasoning for capturing Dream is to bargain with death through Dream in order to get his son back, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then Dream is unwilling to work with him. And so there is this sibling relationship between the living son and the dead son that the living son cannot get out of this relationship, like this sibling relationship, because the dead son has been idolized and idealized in the mind of the father. And now the living son is a disappointment and so on and so forth. So that was the first one. Then when Dream returns to the dreamscape, like his realms, we see Cain and Abel. And Cain and Abel are repeatedly going through the experience of he kills, you know, Cain kills Abel, right? I think that's the right way. And buries him. And then he is like reborn kind of every day. And so we have this, we have the literal first siblings in some mythologies and the first murderer, which I also thought was really interesting. In their existence. But again, they're only in one episode. They don't really, things we don't explain. And then obviously Dream has his siblings. And then also in the Rose story, Rose is trying to get to be reconnected with her brother who they had been separated. So there is this recurring theme of siblings and separated siblings kind of being reconnected or still that relationship still working, even if they're not all living or together.
Yeah, well, there's something really interesting there. I mean, there's probably somebody who would know a little bit more, say like about like attachment theories and like, you know, some of the psychologies that happen around families that have siblings. Cause I think, yeah, it is, I think like just even just thinking it through a little is that if your sort of developmental experience is not just between a parent and a child or like as a child to a parent, but as a child to a parent with another child who has similar, but not identical desires, you know, like food and comfort and et cetera, and a different relationship to that figure. And like it's part of what you know as your life. So there's like an element of conflict or at least like tension there. I think that's there's something really interesting there about what that is to tension but also love. You know, like that there is a like with Cain and Abel, it's interesting that it's like Cain keeps killing Abel, but you get the impression that they do still care about each other.
Totally. It's part of their normal routine. Like when Abel comes back. And like literally comes out of the ground, something happens and he's like, oh, I don't think anything has happened that will make him kill me yet. Like, I think we're still chill for today. Like, it's just part of their normal day to day. And they do have this otherworldly acknowledgement of who they are in story that I think the Dream characters have. Oh, we forgot about a change. Well, the Corinthian changes form, also unexplained, because the Corinthian is, for Doctor Who fans, Jenna Coleman, in like the past, and then in the present is the guy with teeth eyes, with teeth for eyes, which they don't explain how she is the Corinthian and how.
Oh, are you talking about the one that's in the bar?
Yes, but she also shows up a few times, like kind of throughout time. Am I getting that wrong?
Well, so there is a character in the bar story where they go, they meet at the same bar every year or every 100 years, where she's actually connected to the, she's the one who helps Dream find her, find his sand.
Yeah.
So that's not the Corinthian, it's Constantine is her
name.
Oh,
I am wrong Joanna then.
Okay.
So then you can either edit that out or you can let the people know that I am human and and everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah, you know, just blame an Archon. That's my take on
it. An Archon made me do it. Yeah.
An Archon,
t-shirts. Oh my gosh.
There we go. There's a merch idea.
It's happening. Yeah, that was my only thought, was like the siblings of it all.
Yes, I think that's really interesting.
No answers, just questions.
Yeah, well, and I think there is in a lot of Gnostic cosmology, like there is this idea, like Sophia is both like a mother and like a relation to a lot of the demiurges and archons, even though she's kind of also a path to Gnosis. And like, yeah, so family dynamics. I mean, like, try to find me a mythology that doesn't have family dynamics in it. Like, it's that thing of like echoing, you know, imprinting upwards, you know, like we live in a world of family dynamics. And so we engage with a world in family dynamics. Like, and, you know, so one thing that I think is also just a quick thing here about Cain and Abel and Joanna Constantine is that what the show avoids, or it doesn't engage with as much, is that the comic existed when it was published within the DC universe. So this is the universe of Batman and Superman and all of that. Like Batman shows up in one story very briefly, like, and characters like Joanna Constantine are based on another character invented by Alan Moore called John Constantine for the Swamp Thing comics. Without going deep into that, because that's a whole other show, but Cain and Abel also existed in the DC comics as hosts, kind of like Tales from the Crypt Keeper, of a series of comics called, I think, Tales of Mystery and I think Tales of Murder or something like that. And that they would be in these houses and they would kind of like welcome you in. Do you want a tale of murder or do you want a tale of mystery? Like, you know.
Oh, that's cool. So, okay, so this is full circle back to your, like, there's reward for people who are familiar. Like, they're like Easter eggs almost in this larger thing, but that it wouldn't, unless you're me and you just think everyone's the Corinthian, it wouldn't bother you.
No,
it wouldn't bother you to not know.
No. Well, and it led to a good moment of just kind of engaging with where that concept comes from, and where those characters come from. And I think like it is interesting how the show doesn't not use those characters, but also doesn't worry about using them the way they were used in the comics as related to their greater DC Comics lives. I think that's kind of interesting to me. Which again, maybe goes back to this idea of like mythology being, not about what was true, like in terms of how it was published before, and again, this notion of true versus useful, like there's a, because fans will complain like, oh, this character was a different race or a different gender or what have you. But I think like, without being reductive, there's a part of me that wants to go like, the character that you're referring to as the original is still fictional. Like, you know,
100%. The number of hours that we all as human beings spend arguing about things that we made up is like baffling to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it goes back to my thing about being true or useful is like, is it more useful for Dream, say, to be played by a different ethnicity? You know, I would argue yes. It's more interesting. It's more relevant to today it's a choice. And it's also Neil Gaiman adapting it. So like, it's not like someone else is doing this at, you know, like say a producer's behest or something like that. This is the creator of the comic deciding as a creator of the show or an executive producer or whatever, you know. This is a change that is, you know, that we're making, and that like, kind of again going back to this notion of like mythological truths, religious truths, that is it useful and resonant today, you know, versus needing it to have been accurate to an original text or a previous text. I do want to maybe like one quick side thing there. I know we keep finding more things to talk about, but I'll try to wrap it up after this, is that I keep saying true versus, or useful versus true. One thing I do want to maybe really be clear about is that the criteria for it being useful isn't just whether or not I like it or my friends like it or what have you. Like, there is a level of like aesthetic rigor that I think has to be applied. Like, you know, does it stand up to more than just like what makes me maybe feel powerful or you know, justified or what have you? Like, does it open itself up to mystery? Does it challenge me? Like, things like that. And I think that, like, I think a lot of aesthetic criticism, like literary criticism, you know, art criticism, is a great way of engaging with spiritual criticism, because these are, they're not like, no one can tell you that this, you know, say novel is wrong, but they can defend their position about why it's not useful, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like my issue with the casting of Despair, to me, that's not a useful picture anymore, because it is now working to support a narrative or a worldview that I no longer think is useful, true, or working. Mm-hmm. So to me, that casting choice is not useful. And also, I'm not going to go in also, because that's going to take us down a hole. I could be here for hours. Just Sandman folding in on myself.
Maybe we'll leave it there for now. But yeah. if we're both like, hey, we've actually got like 12 more things we should talk about. You know, it's like it's 11 episodes on Netflix. There's, you know, we've only spent an hour and 30 talking about it so far. There's more to talk about.
And also, if anyone's listening to this and is like, must have more Sandman content, then let us know. Because if we're just, we can just talk to ourselves, that's fine. But
yeah.
If you're clamoring for more conversation about the Sandman, let us know.
If you disagree, like, actually, I would love to do another follow-up show where we respond to people disagreeing with, like, some of our takes.
Not the hot ones, though. Just kidding.
Especially the hot ones.
Especially the hot ones, yeah.
Yeah. Great. Okay, well, so I'm going to do some of the wrap-up stuff here. Do you want to say the name of your website while I put it up on the screen?
Yeah, sure. You can find me at RebeccaSkolnick.com. Here's the spelling for you right there. And that's kind of the gateway into most of my work. You can find me on social media through my website. You can also find more podcasts that I've been a part of, some that I've hosted and created, some that I've just been a guest on, as well as my book, which is called The Witch's Book of Numbers. And we have a direct link to it right there. But when you're on my site, I've made it very easy for you. It just says, buy my book. So you can just click on that.
Is there like a short, like, you know, bite-size sales pitch for the book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So The Witch's Book of Numbers meets you in the intersection of witchcraft and numerology, which is a tool that looks at the divine language or the divinity of numbers. And so the book is... for anybody, I really have tried to put something in there for everyone, whether you are like super witchy, want to work with pagan sabbats and have ritual witchcraft, or if you're just a history nerd or like a story buff, there's myth, there's legend, there's the history of kind of numerology and the study of numbers. But yeah, there's a little something in there for everyone. So it's just about numbers and how to add that to your life.
Amazing. And I'm Jason Memel. You can find me at jasonmemel.com. Pretty easy to find there. If you happen to be in Calgary, then you can come to productions that I put on through Sage Theater, and that's sagetheater.com. If you're not in Calgary, well, I guess we'll see you next time. And maybe the other thing too is just, let us know about anything you had a question about the show. And or thoughts or disagreements or hot takes or things you agree with, whatever. Look forward to more Popnosis soon. I think that's it. We'll say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.